From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. The trial of Nazi mass murderer Klaus Barbie brought 40-year-old issues of collaboration and resistance to life in France. Journalist Ted Morgan covered that trial and sought out the recollections of France of 40 years ago. His report is his new book, An Uncertain Hour, on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, Polish film director Jerzy Skolimowski tells us about his new movie, Torrents of Spring, and how his experiences as a director helped him prepare for his role as a KGB agent in White Knight. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Richard Gere's new picture, Internal Affairs. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Romania today outlawed the Communist Party, becoming the first East European state and Warsaw Pact member to do so. Thousands of cheering demonstrators in central Bucharest greeted the announcement by interim president Ion Iliescu. Romania's three-week-old provisional government bowed to popular pressure at the end of a national day of mourning for an estimated 10,000 people killed in the December Revolution that toppled communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. In a second concession to the emotional crowd, Iliescu, himself a former chief of ideology for the Communist Party, agreed to hold a referendum on the death penalty later this month. An agreement was reached in Bulgaria today restoring religious and cultural rights to the country's minority Muslim population. Most of them are Turks. Malcolm Brabant filed this report from the BBC in Sofia.
The communist government, opposition leaders, and the nationalists are all happy with the document that is the product of a week of difficult discussion. The communists, supported by the opposition, managed to convince the nationalist negotiators that the Muslim minority had a constitutional right to enjoy the same civil liberties as other Bulgarians. Muslim rights were severely curtailed by the country's former hardline leader, Todor Zhivkov, in 1984. Under today's agreement, Bulgaria's 1.5 million Muslims will be able to have Islamic names and to reject the Bulgarian ones forced on them by the Zhivkov regime. They'll also be free to practice their religion. A new law will be enacted to enshrine their rights. Concessions to the nationalists included guarantees that there'll be no autonomous Turkish enclaves within Bulgaria.
Malcolm Brabant in Sofia. Attorneys involved in the case of the United States versus Manuel Noriega met in closed-door sessions with the presiding federal judge in Miami today, Jeff White reports.
There was speculation that the prosecution wanted to discuss moving Noriega from his cell in Miami's federal courthouse to some undisclosed location. But when they emerged, none of the attorneys would comment on the meeting, as the judge had ordered the outcome kept secret. Meanwhile, Daniel Miranda, who was indicted along with Noriega on one count of transporting drug money from the U.S. to Panama, was also in federal court for a bond hearing. The judge said the time Miranda would spend in jail before his trial even starts might be greater than his sentence if convicted. So he declared Miranda eligible for bond and set it at $1 million. His attorneys indicated he could probably make that bond. Miranda's attorney, Michael O'Kane, appeared in court with a bandaged head from an assault this morning, which police don't believe had anything to do with the Miranda or Noriega cases. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
Record cold weather helped push wholesale prices sharply higher in December. The 0.7% increase was driven sharply higher by higher energy costs, and that helped drive the Dow Jones Industrial Average 71 points lower. This is NPR News. Researchers in Utah and three other states say they are ready to test an artificial lung in human patients. The device is designed to serve as a temporary substitute for human lungs.
The artificial lung will not replace human lungs. It'll sit inside the main vein in the chest and will take over lung functions for up to 7 days. Researchers say that will give failing lungs time to heal. Four hospitals have received Food and Drug Administration approval for up to 10 experimental human implants. They include LDS Hospital here in Salt Lake City and medical centers at Penn State University, the University of Michigan, and the University of Southern California. The device itself is a long and narrow bundle of hollow tubes connected to a pump outside the body. The synthetic lung removes carbon dioxide and injects oxygen at about half the normal rate. Researchers say the lung should be cheaper and easier to use than existing respirators. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
Ford Motor Company said today it plans to put up for sale its Ford Aerospace subsidiary in order to concentrate on automobiles and financial services. Industry analysts say the sale of Ford's aerospace holdings will raise critical funds for its auto business, but the company will be selling into a market depressed by pending defense cutbacks. A Ford spokesman said the company hopes to sell the unit whole, but added he would examine all offers. General Motors said today it will reduce hiring, delay product plans, and encourage salary workers either to resign or retire early. The latest spending cuts come amid a slumping domestic car market and intensified competition. Carmaker said the new cuts are in line with a plan launched in 1987 aimed at saving $10 billion by 1990. A Marine Corps jet crashed at a busy intersection in suburban Philadelphia today, injuring a pilot but apparently causing no other casualties. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. My guest today is journalist and biographer Ted Morgan. His new book is An Uncertain Hour: The French, the Germans, the Jews, the Klaus Barbie trial, and the city of Lyon. The story of Klaus Barbie is a personal story for Morgan, as well as a compelling illumination of history. Morgan was born Sanche de Grammont in France in the 1930s. His family fled the Nazis during the war and came to the United States. In 1977, he became an American citizen and changed his name to an anagram of de Grammont, Ted Morgan. He's written about that experience in the autobiographical book On Becoming American. Morgan has also written several biographies, including books on William Burroughs, Somerset Maugham, and Franklin Roosevelt. An Uncertain Hour details information uncovered during the trial of war criminal Klaus Barbie in Lyon. Morgan obtained a copy of the 10,000 pages of secret documents prepared for the trial, which reveal new information about resistance and collaboration in France during the Nazi occupation. Morgan went to Lyon to cover the trial for the New York Times magazine. I asked Ted Morgan what compelled him to be a reporter there.
You see, I'm originally French, and I grew up in Paris, and my father, at the beginning of the war in 1940, went to London and joined General de Gaulle and became a bomber pilot, and flew a certain number of missions over Germany, and then was killed in an accident in 1943. And that's something that's always sort of stayed with me. And so I wanted to, the trial for me was an opportunity to go back and sort of investigate and find out more about that period. Because in 1940, we saw the Germans come in. After my father left, my mother and my brothers and myself stayed in France in the unoccupied zone, and the Germans came in, and then they left again once the country was divided into the two zones, and we got out through Spain and Portugal and came back to this country. So I felt that I'd sort of missed out on the occupation years.
What was your feeling about going back to France and covering something that had been clearly a very intensely personal issue in time for the French people?
Well, my feeling was to find out more about it. And as Lincoln said on the eve of the Battle of Gettysburg, we cannot escape history. And so you're stuck with this, you know, because of what happened to my father, and you're just stuck with this period that you can't get out of, which is, to me, the occupation. And it was just a chance to discover, to get more detail on it, to see through the prism of this trial and all the... There were hundreds of witnesses. They all came and told their stories. It was fascinating. It was like theater to me. And then the war criminal himself, to try to fathom what he was like, and it was a great experience, I thought.
The war trial of Klaus Barbie seemed to bring up issues in France like scratching an old scab. It brought up issues of collaboration and of resistance. It seemed actually to be a time where France tried to sort of re-examine and scratch itself again.
Yeah, there was a lot of that, and because the French were, I think, after the war, heavily into denial. And de Gaulle came, and he sort of justified he had done the right thing. He had resisted. He had opposed the Germans. But when you're on the spot and in a city like Lyon, the people who were there, I mean, it divides into many subcategories, you know. For instance, the great majority just went on with their lives as usual. And then you have those who were actively resisting, you have those who were actively collaborating, you have the businessmen who are doing business with the Germans. You have, for instance, in France during the occupation, there was a very thriving film industry. All those movies were made with German permission and sometimes with German co-producers and with German money. And they were, some of them are very great movies, like Les Enfants du Paradis was made during the occupation with German approval.
Can you describe a bit of the atmosphere of the courtroom of Lyon?
Yeah, well, it was very crowded, and it was not held in a regular courtroom. They took the huge entrance room of the tribunal and turned it into a courtroom, and they had three judges, and in these red robes with ermine fringes. And then they had a glass booth for Barbie, and he would come in and step into this glass booth. And then you had the prosecutor, and then you had about 25 lawyers who were representing victims of Barbie, and they were allowed to be there, not exactly as co-prosecutors, but they asked questions, and they each represented one of the victims who came and acted as a witness in the trial. So you had a lot of lawyers all in their black robes, and then you had a big, big press gallery. And it started, I believe, it would start around 1 in the afternoon and then go on until about 6. And then you had the problem that Barbie didn't want to testify because he said that he'd been kidnapped out of Bolivia, where he'd gone after escaped after the war. And so for most of the time, he wasn't even there. And that was very anticlimactical because you expect him to be confronted, because some of the people that he arrested and tortured in Lyon were sent to the camps, and they came back, and they were able to testify against him. And there were a couple of confrontations like that that were extremely emotional, because the people who had come back from the camps, when confronted with him, they completely lost their composure, and one of them, you know, tried to go for him and toward the booth and had to be restrained, and another one one woman, you know, practically fainted, and there were some very dramatic moments. But it was a very long trial. It lasted for over 2 months, and most of the time, as I say, Barbie wasn't even there. And then, of course, at the end, there was a jury. There's a jury of 9 in France, plus the three judges sit with the jury. And it's not like the American system. The judges and the jury deliberate together. And so they deliberated for a few hours, and I think when they brought the verdict in, it was around midnight, and we were all sitting there waiting. And they came in and they gave the verdict, and then they brought Barbie in for the last time to hear the verdict, and the judge asked him, "Do you have anything to say?" And he said, "I did some hard things, but it was the war, and now the war is over." That's what he said. And I remember thinking at the time, it's never over, and that's why he's here, you know.
My guest is Ted Morgan. His new book is An Uncertain Hour. One of the astonishing aspects of this time of French history, 1940 to 45, was the degree of collaboration that went on, and in fact was brought up as a topic many times, both in the press and during the trial. What astonished you most about the collaboration in France?
Well, there again, it's the variety of the collaboration. You have people who, for instance, went into the Charlemagne SS division. This was a German SS division made up of French volunteers, and some of them were interviewed afterward, and one of them said that he would, it wasn't that he liked the Germans, but he would rather be fighting the Russians on the Eastern Front than be involved with the Vichy government. So out of a distaste for Vichy, he joins the SS. It's really bizarre. And then you had the guy who was running a newspaper in Paris, and so he had to run the paper the way the Germans wanted it. So he went along and he became a collaborator because he wanted to continue running his paper. He had journalists who wanted to continue getting their bylines. And so they, you know, were turning out this collaborationist paper. So you had many, many kinds of collaboration. You had some ideological collaboration that were anti-Semites and pro-Nazi, and they collaborated out of conviction. And then you had the ones that did it to get a job promotion or something like that. I mean, there were many kinds of collaboration.
The sense of this time of the occupation was that anti-Semitic French could use it as an excuse to cover up their anti-Semitic activities.
Not only an excuse, but they were actively encouraged to act out their anti-Semitic feelings, and that was one of the worst things about Vichy, that it had a state. There was a state policy of anti-Semitism, and Vichy at first went along with the Germans on their deportation program, and one of the things that not shocked exactly, but that surprised me, was the extent of the police, of the French police involvement in the deportations, because the Germans didn't want to use their own army, their own soldiers, to deport Jews. And the Vichy made a deal with the Germans that if the Germans deported foreign Jews instead of French Jews, they would help the Germans do it. And their rationale was, we're protecting our own French Jews, because there were a great many foreign Jews in France. And so Vichy used its own police to round up the foreign Jews, to take them to certain detention camps in France, and then to take them from the detention camps to the trains. And there were literally tens of thousands of foreign Jews who were sent to the camps this way, and I could not find one single example of one single French policeman who ever said, I will not do this. And although there were cases when the French police would give advance notice to certain Jews, but this is particularly in Paris that this happened, and tip them off and say, you'd better not be at home tomorrow or something like that. Or in one case, there was a little a mother with her two daughters, and the police came, and the mother said, "Oh, I can't let my daughter go until I've combed her hair, and I can't find the comb." And one of the policemen said to the girl, "Why don't you go down to the store downstairs and get a comb?" And he was giving her a chance to escape, and she went down there, and then she came back because she didn't know where to go. Mm-hmm. And so there were stories like that.
How hard was it for you as a writer and a researcher to hear these stories and to come across them? I would think that some of them would be enough to make you weep.
It's not it was on a daily basis, and there was story after story after story, and it's discouraging to listen to that, you know. And of course, on the other hand, you did have the witnesses who survived and who came back to tell the story, and I thought it was quite wonderful that after all these years they were still around and could describe what they'd been through. And again, in this Lyon thing with Barbie, when he raided the Jewish welfare office in the heart of Lyon, and some of the people there were able to get away. And there was one woman there, and she came in, you know, because it was the day where people came in for medical. There was a doctor on duty that day, so there were a lot of people there. And then the Gestapo came in and raided it and stayed there. And so every time somebody else came in, the door was opened by a Gestapo man who said, "Come on in," you know. And then they were stuck, and they were arrested. And so this one woman had some sheet music. She'd just come from her piano lesson. And one of the Gestapo men picks up the sheet music, and he could read music, and he sees that it's a Beethoven piano thing, and he starts humming it, you know, and then he gives it back to her and says, "You can leave." And so she was able to get out of it because she had some German sheet music on her. And so it's just endlessly, you know, an endless variety of human behavior in these stories.
My guest is Ted Morgan. He covered the trial of fugitive war criminal Klaus Barbie for the New York Times Magazine. He's expanded that story into his new book, An Uncertain Hour: The French, the Germans, the Jews, the Klaus Barbie Trial, and the City of Lyon. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with writer Ted Morgan. Although you've given up your French citizenship, you're still very moved by memories of your youth, patriotic memories, including a troop of soldiers, mostly veterans of World War I, called the Broken Faces. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could talk about who these people were and when you remember seeing them.
Well, in World War I, in the trench warfare, the shrapnel, they had these shells that exploded in the air before they hit the ground, and the shrapnel would fly all over the place. And as a result, there were a great many face wounds. And this was quite common, and they had a special ward in the Val de Grasse Hospital in Paris for these so-called broken faces called gueule cassée. So when I was a boy in Paris, my father took me to this 14th of July, the great 14 juillet parade, and I was sitting on his shoulders, and he said, "Here come the gueule cassée," and because they marched a detachment of them every 14 juillet in the parade, and one of them's carrying a flag, and they're all marching, you know, high stepping and everything. And as they get closer, I see that, you know, one of them has a leather patch where his nose should be. Another one has a face that looks like oatmeal, you know. I mean, it was just a ghastly sight, and that sort of gives you a kind of historical continuity to the whole story, because these guys were mangled in World War I. Then 20 years later, it starts all over again in 1940, and then there's another generation that goes out.
You described the gueule cassée, the broken faces in the Bastille Day parade, as representing a time of unjudging and unconditional patriotism, but that you didn't think that after World War II there were any more in the parade. What changed in France between World War I and World War II that went from this time of great intense patriotism to one of willing collaboration?
Uh-huh. What changed, I think, was that the next war came too quickly. And people are exhausted, and you can't ask people to go through something like that again. And so the whole mentality at the beginning of World War II was completely different. There was no enthusiasm. There was no will to win. there was a completely defensive mentality, which is illustrated by the Maginot Line, which is really saying, we're not going to attack you if you don't attack us.
Were you astonished by the role that Americans played after World War II in making it possible for German war criminals to escape? You adopted America as your new country, mm-hmm. and did this surprise you, or did it seem sort of natural given the climate of the times?
It seemed, in an odd way, it seemed natural because when the American military intelligence recruited Barbie in 1947, the Cold War had begun. Germany had been carved up into four occupation zones. Germany was no longer dangerous. They had caught most of the major war criminals. They had had the Nuremberg trial and convicted them, and the ones who had escaped weren't talked about that much. And so they had recruited Galen, and who came with all his files to the military intelligence to hand over everything he knew, and they wanted to find professional intelligence people to do their espionage on the Russians. The Cold War was on, and so in a way it was logical for them to hire someone like Barbie, even though he was morally reprehensible. And I talked to all his CIC handlers, as they were called. They're still around. They're very, very nice men. And they said, well, you know, that was our job. We were supposed to collect intelligence. I said, well, didn't you feel that this man was a swine? I said, no, we worked with him, and we didn't know that much about him, really. It hadn't come out yet. And so in the logic of the times, they were simply hiring professional intelligence people who knew their jobs to spy on the Russians and to spy on on German communists, which was one of their targets, to infiltrate the German Communist Party and the German labor movement. And Barbie was pretty good at that.
An Uncertain Hour seems to be then a chronicle of pragmatic behavior.
I'm afraid that's true, that most people do act pragmatically. Now, the people who don't act pragmatically are the ideologues, and on the ideologues on both sides. That is, the people who believe ahead of their own interests in their country, like the resistance heroes, like Jean Moulin, for instance. And the collaborators are also ideologues who are the worst abettors of the Nazis, who did the occupiers dirty work for them.
Well, Ted Morgan, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Ted Morgan's new book is An Uncertain Hour, The French, the Germans, the Jews, the Klaus Barbie Trial, and the City of Lyon. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Film director Jerzy Skolimowski left his native Poland when he couldn't get his movies past the government censors. But he continued his filmmaking in the West, directing the movie Moonlighting, starring Jeremy Irons, and acting as the KGB agent in White Nights. Coming up, Jerzy Skolimowski talks with us about his new movie, Torrents of Spring, starring Timothy Hutton and Nastasia Kinski. World music critic Milo Miles shows us what kinds of sounds are coming out of Yugoslavia. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Internal Affairs, starring Richard Gere and Andy Garcia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Leaders of a grassroots independence movement in the Soviet Republic of Lithuania have angrily condemned Soviet leader Gorbachev's proposal to set up a mechanism allowing republics to secede from the Soviet Union. These grassroots leaders accuse Gorbachev of laying a propaganda trap designed to hinder rather than ease the country's exit from the Soviet Union. Ann Cooper reports from Vilnius.
Leaders of the nationalist movement Sąjūdis were responding to Gorbachev's announcement yesterday that the government plans a national debate on a draft law governing secession. Lithuanians contend they have the right to decide on their own whether to remain within the Soviet Union, which annexed this Baltic republic 5 decades ago. They believe Gorbachev's plan would prevent secession by giving others a voice in deciding Lithuania's fate. But Sąjūdis leaders say they will ignore Gorbachev's proposal. Lithuania will continue to demand its independence, said one Sąjūdis council member, and they will not wait, he said, for an endless discussion of a new law. For National Public Radio, this is Ann Cooper in Vilnius.
The president of Romania declared today that the Communist Party in the country has been abolished. President Ion Iliescu, speaking before some 10,000 protesters in Bucharest, also said the government will hold a vote the 28th of this month to allow the people to decide whether or not to reinstate the death penalty. Secretary of State Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze will hold talks early next month in Moscow. Their main purpose is to advance a treaty under negotiation to cut nuclear weapons, but unrest in the Baltic states and Eastern Europe will also be discussed. Barry Schwide reports.
Baker and Shevardnadze will be following up on a decision taken at the Malta summit to tackle three key arms control problems: air-launched cruise missiles, information on missile tests, and storing non-deployed missiles. Still, U.S. officials said Baker also wants to talk to Shevardnadze about regional conflicts and is bound to get into the situation in Lithuania and elsewhere. In that regard, U.S. policy is to affirm support for self-determination for the Baltic people and then say little else. Officials refuse to say if support for self-determination means support for establishment of separate nations carved out of the USSR. Gorbachev has warned that development could uproot his reform program. That's a program the U.S. wants to see succeed. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwartz at the State Department.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 71 points to close at 2,689.21 on volume of 183 million shares. Trading was heavy as declining issues led advances 7-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Until recently, most Westerners pictured life in Eastern Europe as grim and silent. But world music commentator Milo Miles has been listening to some music from Yugoslavia that he says contradicts that image.
When I speak of world music in these features, I mean music that has resulted from growing worldwide culture. I mean music that responds to international media, portable cassettes playing in all countries, electric guitars and synthesizers spreading everywhere. I do not mean folk music from around the world. But occasionally, bands that stick pretty much to local traditions come up with albums that are so bumptious, so vigorous, and so much fun, they have to be mentioned. One such recording is Blow, Bishir, Blow, by Jova Bishir Stiljakovic and his brass orchestra. These Yugoslavians don't play polkas. They are not quaint. They are party animals, especially at wedding parties, it turns out. In this country, Bishir and the Orchestra would be called a general business band, since they play for feast days, inaugurations, whatever's available. And since everybody knows they're good, they represent Yugoslavia at international music festivals. It's Bishir and the guy's straightforward, everyman professionalism that you catch right away, that and the foot-stomping bass lines. They're not finicky museum keepers of folk culture, but a hard-working band that wants you to have a good time. Spanish influence is evident in the Orchestra's trumpet solos. In fact, quite a crisscross of sounds from Europe and the Middle East turns up in the Orchestra's repertoire. Here's a familiar tune given the unique Orchestra treatment and called Israel Orient. Of course, the brass orchestra will interest those who already like the Bulgarian women's choir albums. Funny thing is, though, I'm sure Bishir would win over confirmed fans of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band and other New Orleans ensembles. Maybe guys who like to pick up horns and lead a dance in the streets are the same around the world.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes regularly about pop music for the Village Voice. He reviewed Blow Bishir Blow on the British Globe Style label. This is Fresh Air. Polish emigre and film director Jerzy Skolimowski is best known in this country for his 1982 film, Moonlighting. Skolimowski also wrote the screenplay. The film starred Jeremy Irons as the foreman of a Polish work crew illegally in London to renovate the home of a wealthy Pole. While on the job, a military coup occurs in Poland. The house used in the film is Skolimowski's. He had left Poland for the West 10 years before he made Moonlighting and was living in London. Skolimowski also works in front of the camera. Filmgoers will remember him as the convincing KGB agent who harasses the character played by Mikhail Baryshnikov in White Nights. Skolimowski's new film is opening this month. It's called Torrents of Spring. It's based on the novel by Ivan Turgenev and stars Timothy Hutton and Nastasya Kinski. I asked him what drew him to the works of Turgenev.
Well, you know, I've read the book very early on when I was still in school, and that was during the very dark Stalinist area, you know, when I was still in a high school in the 1950s, and we had to read a lot of terrible literature. It was dealing all with the Stakhanovs, you know, the people who were doing the 500% of working norms. And just very few books were of a higher class of literature. Among them, what we were allowed to read at that time was Turgenev.
You made a movie there in 1967 that eventually led to your exile, your leaving of Poland?
Yes, the movie was the subject of the censorship, and I strongly protest against that decision, and I was fighting that much that I was even allowed to face number two of the Politburo, which was quite unusual, you know, that the young filmmaker was given the 5 minutes time of that distinguished man. And I was talking to him for 5 minutes and protesting against the decision of the censorship that the film will never be shown. And after 5 minutes, when he looked at the watch, giving me the sign that my time is up, he just said one word, no. And that was it.
How much of that experience of dealing with a police state did you bring to your characterization of the KGB agent in the Taylor Hackford film White Nights? And how much of it was based on your sense of what a director needs to be in control?
Well, actually, your question was well put, because, first of all, Taylor wanted to have a film director to play that very part. The reason for that was that he wanted somebody who would feel so confident on the film set, like exactly the KGB officer would feel in his office or doing his duty. So I know that I was, when I was testing for that part, I was against Miloš Forman and some other people. And, well, Taylor found me somehow right for the part. And, of course, I use my own experience when I was subjected to those. You can't even say that there were investigations, but, you know, the fact that you had to deal with those people, that was all already quite unpleasant. But at the same time, I was able to make useful observations, which I eventually used playing that part.
You've worked as an actor in other films as well, and I wonder, as a director, how you react to the idea of giving up control to somebody else to perform. Is it easier for you to be an actor than a director?
It is easier because, you know, knowing a film set like, you know, like your own pocket, I am aware of everything what's going on, and still the responsibility, it's not on my shoulders, so I can think about my lines and proper use of the props and costume, and that's it.
In White Nights, you spoke with a Russian accent, and you speak with a Polish accent now, and you were in a film being made in Chicago in 1986 where you had to speak with an American accent. Did you feel comfortable absorbing a sort of a Chicago sound in your voice?
Well, I was heavily dialogue coached, I must say, and I think it worked pretty well. You know, I can still produce some of those sounds.
Could I hear some of those sounds?
If I remember any line, let me think. Lieutenant Anderson, Chicago Police, something like that.
Did it feel comfortable doing that, or did you feel strained and like you were doing a comic act?
No, not at all. No. If no. I felt I was a gangster.
It sounded very convincing. That was for a film called Big Shots.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me most about your film Moonlighting was the the lack of dialogue in it. In particular, one of my favorite scenes was when Jeremy Irons comes back from the grocery store laden with food, and he is setting it out on a shelf, and he's counting it. And you can see in his assessment hunger and strained resources and the strain in his face. And without words, all he does is move his hand across the food and touches each loaf, each can. And it was a very powerful scene. And I'm wondering if that scene evolved or if you thought it out in advance.
Well, I guess the scene was in the script. And as you said, the use of the dialogue is rather limited. Because, you know, for a realistic purpose, if we would hear them talking, they should talk Polish. And then I would be obliged to use the subtitles, which I didn't want. And just those very few words used in Polish were not necessary to translate, because they were obvious, you know, people could judge from the screen what they are talking about.
In Moonlighting, there was very little use of color. There was it came across as a color black and white movie, except for some scenes in the grocery store. And I wonder if this was intentional or just a function of the season of year that you were shooting it. There was so little, say, greenery in the movie.
It was intentional. You see, what I wanted was to create an impression that we have a concentration camp in the central London, because those people actually were locked, you know, in that little house which they were renovating. And with the martial law going on in Poland, they somehow become a part of that Polish situation, still being in a so-called free country. And I think those gloomy colors helped to create that atmosphere.
There was a startling scene in which there was a blue truck that suddenly goes across. It was an eerie effect after looking at what had been kind of a grim visual scene for a while. Compelling, but grim.
Yes, the biggest problem was those red London buses, you know, because once you get that red into the screen, you suddenly see that, you know, that the whole color palette exist. But I use it just a few times. You see those red buses.
What are the criteria that you use to decide whether or not you want to make a film?
Well, it's different all the time. You know, for example, with my new project, which I'm working on right now, is the book by the Polish 20th century classic. His name is Gombrowicz. Gombrowicz is he's a really kind of intellectual guru in Europe, especially in France. So no wonder that I have a French co-producer already, you know, almost on his knees. You know, they are saying, "Oh, Gombrowicz, Gombrowicz," you know. So the fact that I've chosen this book to adopt it to the film is a quite complex decision. At the time when we see rather, I can't find any better word than silly achievements, you know, in the cinema. The book is extremely funny. It's a kind of almost a parody on the fact that we all behave very artificially. His thesis, his general thesis, is that people put faces on each other faces. You know, that fortunately we are talking now. You are in Philadelphia and I am in New York, so I managed to keep my private face, and so probably you do too.
Mm-hmm.
But if we would be facing each other, we would be making faces to each other, and vice versa. You know, we would be responding somehow with our faces. So Gombrowicz is pointing out that, you know, that that people's relationship affect them into something which is quite artificial and dishonest.
How would you, as a director, describe your face as an actor?
Flexible, I would say. I can play any given part, I guess, if the lines are right.
Your father was the architect who designed the subway system for Poland. Is that
yes,
right?
He was one of the people who built the first underground train in Warsaw before the Second World War. How do you know that?
Research. And is the subway still running? The underground still running there?
No, except that one single piece, which was built by my father. But they are still working on the proper, subway system. And I guess in the middle of 90s, it would be ready.
When you return to Poland, do you take a ride on that section of the train as a ceremonial ride?
Certainly I will, yes.
Well, Jerzy Skolimowski, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Jerzy Skolimowski's new film, Torrents of Spring, opens this month. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later today here on National Public Radio is All Things Considered. Co-host Noah Adams has stopped by to give us a preview. Hello, Noah.
Hi there. Soviet leader Gorbachev is visiting Lithuania, continuing his trip there, trying to hold on to that Baltic Republic. The Lithuanian people want independence. Robert Siegel talks with some coal miners from the Soviet Union about changes in their country. We'll have an update on a bad day on the stock market in the U.S. And I'll talk with Willis Allen Ramsey, a Texas-trained singer-songwriter who had a very successful 1972 debut album and no recording since that time, even though the first album is still selling very well.
A full edition of All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. Last fall, Sea of Love was the cop thriller of the season, helped by a sustained level of sexual tension. This winter, a new thriller is out called Internal Affairs. The cops are played by Richard Gere and Andy Garcia. Movie critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
You can tell a lot about a movie from production details. Are the clothes right? And the cars and the houses and the characters' accents? Is the attention to detail refined enough to make you feel you can trust the movie? That seeming inconsistencies will later prove logical and plot holes be filled. In the case of Internal Affairs, the answer is always no. The clothes are ludicrous. People live in improbably fancy digs. And why would Richard Gere, playing a cop on the take, advertise his malfeasance to the world by tootling around in a shiny red Corvette? Sure enough, the plot sometimes turns to Swiss cheese, and the ending is so abrupt and unfulfilling that the audience I saw the movie with hissed. But I didn't care. For all its problems, Internal Affairs is an extraordinarily taut, sexy police thriller, and I enjoyed almost every minute of it. Its framework is a duel between two similar cops, both cool on the surface and dangerously hot-blooded underneath. Gere plays the ringleader of a gang of corrupt officers. To his boys and to his legion of children and ex-wives, he's a kind of super pimp, paternal, sometimes very generous, but also controlling, scary, and pitiless. His nemesis is the new cop in Internal Affairs, the division that polices the police. He's Raymond, played by Andy Garcia, with an intensity that sometimes threatens to bubble over the top, but never does. What's masterful about the script by newcomer Henry Bean is its decision to focus on the sexual insecurities that cops naturally acquire, working long and erratic hours in a world where no one tells the truth. Under such circumstances, a wife like Raymond's wife may find herself getting less attention from her husband than she should. And a husband like Raymond may find himself wondering what she does when he's not around. Leave it to an erotic predator like Richard Gere's Dennis Peck to prey on his enemy's most volatile fear.
I'm talking about you, Raymond. I'm talking about me.
Yeah.
But it's not because I see it in you. Because I see it in your wife. I see it in Kathleen.
Oh, you see it in my wife?
Yeah.
In fact, I saw her this morning.
Oh, you saw my
wife?
Saw
at the museum, yeah.
Blonde?
Yeah, long, blonde, curly hair.
Yeah.
She's very pretty, too.
No, she's very, very pretty.
A little skinny for my taste, but they say skinny ones give good pecs, so.
Richard Gere has never been among my favorite actors. As a hero, he always seems self-adoring and hollow. But as a villain in Internal Affairs, he turns out to be marvelous, seducing everyone he meets, dismissing their apprehensions with a warming grin, even suffering in his way when he's compelled to commit evil. Fortunately, Andy Garcia has inner fires of his own, and he's well-balanced by Laurie Metcalf as his no-nonsense partner, the only woman in the movie who doesn't ooze sensuality. The director, Michael Figgis, who also contributed to the film's superb score, has almost too much style for his own good. He sometimes enmeshes his story in magazine glamour and MTV gimmickry, when what it needs is toughness and insight. But he captures the ferocious psychosexual tension between his antagonists in a way that's absolutely riveting. Look past the plot holes and Gere's flashy red Corvette, and you'll find the spiciest police thriller since Sea of Love.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Roberta Shorrock and Joan Tuohy produce our arts commentaries with production assistance from Karen Impola. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Sears tells us what 19th century Americans did when they took a few days off. His new book, Sacred Places, examines the landscape and tourist attractions of the 1800s and why we no longer regard prisons, cemeteries, and mines as destinations worth the journey. That, and of course, much more on the next Fresh Air.